This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is on vacation. Coming up, a week of actions in support of Marissa Alexander and Black women's right to defend themselves, a project to rally families against unfair incarceration, and the deadline approaches to save internet neutrality. But first, the African People's Socialist Party, also known as the Uhuru Movement, has kicked off a month-long period of intensive study in St. Petersburg, Florida, where party cadre have gathered from around the world. Chairman Omali Yeshitela gave the opening speech.
If African people are going to be free, it's going to be because we've made a revolution. But revolution is a science and an art. And what this system has done successfully over many centuries is every instance revolutionary leadership rears its head, it kills it, it wipes it out, it destroys it if it can. And in the last period, we saw that happen with the murders of people like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. We saw this government imprison Marcus Garvey, who tried to unite black people all around the world with the slogan, Africa for Africans, those at home and those abroad, something that resonates even today as we have this discussion. And when we see governments destroy revolutionaries and revolutionary movements, they leave in its place not only stooges and puppets and sometimes idiots and sometimes people suffering from serious mental disorders in place. They don't only do that. They leave a vacuum that's filled by charlatans often and various other kinds of forces who would substitute everything for revolution. So right now, in many ways, here and around the world, we're looking at processes of black people who experiencing a vicious kind of oppression that's more than 500 years long. It's not something that just started in Detroit or in New Jersey or someplace like it's 500 years long that we've been struggling with it. And it's something that's reflected in every experience that we have, whether it's on a school campus, whether it's chartered or public school, whether it's so-called gentrification, all of it is a consequence of this aggression that we've been suffering from a long time. We say over and over again that people like to talk about America being a nation of immigrants, but first of all, that America's not a nation. It's a prison of nations, and that we are not immigrants. We are captives. It's not like we are perhaps other than the so-called Indians, the only people that came to this country not looking for a better way of life, but lost a better way of life as a consequence of having been dragged here, kicking and screaming. We're not the ones who landed in this famous island someplace in New York that welcomed by the Statue of Liberty and the rest of it. Not us. We were fighting fiercely to stay where we were, not to be brought here against our will. And I want to just make that clear, that this is the context of every discussion that we're having. And it's a time for us to have this discussion. Because in the absence of revolutionary leadership, what we find ourselves is faced with all kinds of ridiculous superstitions and nonsense that would divert our people from what our efforts have to revolve around if we are going to be free. That's the question, if we are going to be free. The banks, capitalism, nasty, nasty, nasty capitalism, a social system that has its origin in selling black people. And here you have somebody talking about the virtues of capitalism. This is what they're using, drones to assassinate people around the world to protect this social system. The virtues of capitalism, founded on selling black people, founded on colonialism, stealing the land and resources and sovereignty and dignity of whole peoples all around the world. That's what the whole system rests on. Finance capital. It has no conscience at all. It doesn't care about no little babies. It doesn't care anything about the fact that it presides over a world economy, where 80% of the people of the human beings on earth, 80% of the human beings on earth are trying to exist off less than 10 US dollars a day, where half the people on the planet are trying to survive off less than $3 US a day. And if you are in Africa, you're lucky if you get a dollar a day to live off. That's the social system that we are continuing. It doesn't care about you. When Barack Hussein Obama, we should call him Barack Insane Obama, stands up and talks about fighting for the American way and all the virtues of America, when he's sending drones to assassinate people around the world, it's to protect that relationship. This is the relationship that he's protecting. This is Americanism. And I have to say this because I'm tired of hearing white liberals telling me that, well, you know, the problem is that America must be made America again. I'm not doing this again. The first time around was enough for most of us, right? This is America. This is America. And it has to be uprooted. It has to be uprooted. And some people say that, and particularly white people need data and empirical evidence. That's what they say, but I know it's a lie. Because I know all this other stuff that white people believe didn't even require any empirical evidence about my inferiority, about the right to keep a whole indigenous population in concentration camps that they call Indian reservations, about what's happening in the Middle East. No empirical evidence that is required. George Bush talks about, I don't know if the people in the Middle East, if the democracy will stick there or not, but we, damn it, we're going to bomb them until it happens, right? No empirical evidence that there's something wrong with Arabs or anybody else in the world, but white people didn't have to bring any data, no data, nothing on the computer, no kind of information to prove that to white people. So I disregard that stuff about white people don't believe anything unless you bring evidence to them, because they believe everything about me without a single bit of evidence. I just think that we have to contextualize what we're talking about with the banks running amok. And the fact is that we are talking about a social system. We're not just talking about Detroit. We're not just talking about America. And when we talk about capitalism, capitalism is not simply that something that happens in Detroit. Capitalism is happening in Uganda. The whole world economy is a capitalist world economy that's dominated by capital and capitalism. And it was founded off slavery, founded off colonialism, and it created various kinds of structures to protect itself and structures to maintain itself in existence. And those structures have been placed there. They are political structures, economic structures. And when we say political, I'm talking about military structures as well. I'm talking about NATO. I'm talking about even the United Nations and other entities like that were created for the purpose of facilitating this relationship, facilitating the domination of capital over the rest of us. So capital comes into existence selling my grandparents. That's how I got here. Taking this land. Who is it? Woody Guthrie? Is he the one who said something about this land is my land? You're a damn lie. You know, this land is stolen. What the president said is ours, we stole it fair and square. And the people whose land this is in concentration camps in this country. And it's absolutely necessary for us to understand. If we understand this, if we escape from the lie and the illusion of some, whether through accident, through some magic economic course, that white people emerge as some kind of leadership of world society naturally and normally, then we won't understand anything that's going on. And we always find ourselves trying to solve our problem within the context of that narrative. And what I'm saying is that we live in a world that came to being and that continues today through extraction of tremendous amount of value. There is a finance capital because there is an Indian reservation, because there are people colonized all over the world, because Africans gave hundreds of years of free labor to create this entity that's called America today. There is a finance capital. There is capitalism, period. That's how it came to being. And so everybody knows this, but I say it anyway. Politics ain't nothing but concentrated economics. in the final analysis. And what we have is this political economy born through ripping everybody off in the world that justifies, validates itself through these political and ideological expressions born from that system. You won't find a system that's organized around slavery that will create and develop ideological and political and institutional representations of freedom and justice. A capitalist system will produce capitalist ideology. It will be in the church. It will represent itself in various kinds of cultural manners. Liberals, white liberals, Negro liberals, capitalist liberals, you know, connected to the same kind of social system. But now the system is in great distress, more than any time I've ever seen in my life. This is why I am optimistic, despite what we see in terms of how capital is moving, aggressing against various peoples, including Africans and other people in this country. This is why I'm optimistic, because there is, and we can see it, a tremendous shift, global shift of power that's happening in the world that has capitalism acting in a frenzy, a desperate frenzy. There's a global, you can see it. Every time you turn on your television, every time you go to the internet, every time you read a newspaper, you can see everything is out of control. And what you have now is not a strong capital, not a strong imperialism that is exerting its authority over everybody in the world. You see an imperialism and capitalism fighting for its very life. That's what you see in Afghanistan. That's what you see in Pakistan. That's what you see in Iraq at this very moment. And I'm not talking anything about the character of the forces that are in motion. Because what has happened, clearly, anybody can see this. U.S. and white power ain't what it used to be anymore. It ain't what it used to be anymore. It can't just tell people do this and do that and can expect that it's going to happen just because they said it anymore. And increasingly, they are even incapable of depending on human beings to go fight their wars for them. Yeah, drones are a consequence of technology, but a technology that becomes necessary because it becomes increasingly difficult to get people to go fight for them anymore. Necessity, the mother of invention. It's difficult, more and more difficult to get people to go off and fight these wars for them anymore. So they got some kids sitting up in Colorado behind a computer screen, you know, that can send drones and things like that to kill people. There's a fundamental change that's happening in the world today. And Africans around the world are going to have to engage in revolutionary struggle to overturn this relationship. That's why we're here. That's why we've got people coming here from all around the world. Because, among other things, the social system that we are contending with is an international social system. It's global. It's global. And among other things, when we look at what's happening in Africa, even as white power fights among itself about what it can control in Africa, I say fights among itself, but that's not even an accurate statement anymore, because what they have is proxy wars. So when the United States is dissatisfied with the cut that it has got in Africa, when it's dissatisfied with the ability of France to continue to extract so much value in places where the United States wants to extract value, it doesn't send white boys to go off to war in Central African Republic or something to that. They pick a Negro from the Central African Republic. They fund him from Central African Republic to go and contend with a French-supported Negro from Central African Republic, who then end up fighting war, and the victor is people looking at a war thinking they know what the hell is going on, but it's America and France fighting through proxies. Same thing is happening all over Africa right now, happening in Congo. Something like 7 million Africans have died in Congo since 1998. That's why I don't want to talk to any white people about a peace movement that can only recognize war as something that either immediately or threatens some in the near future, threatens them, and can't recognize what's happening with our people in Congo, can't recognize what the U.S. is doing in Somalia, can't recognize how the U.S. is using Ethiopia and Kenya in Somalia, can't recognize how the U.S. is using Uganda and Rwanda in Congo, can't recognize any of these other kinds of contradictions, can't recognize what's happening to a captive population right here in this country. Africans, people who live in barrios, colonies, you know, right here in the United States. So Africans in this country are colonized. And African people around the world experience some form of colonialism. Whether we are in Sierra Leone, or whether we are in Johannesburg, the fact is the condition of black people around the world has its origin in the initial aggression against Africa. That's why all of us are poor, whether you're in Africa or whether you're in Newark. African people are catching hell. That attack on Africa is the basis of our condition.
Omali Yeshetela of the African People's Socialist Party in St. Petersburg, Florida. The coalition that formed around the campaign to free Marissa Alexander will hold a Stand Our Ground week in Jacksonville, Florida, starting July 25th. Alyssa Bieria, one of the organizers, says the issues go beyond the injustice done to one black woman.
Marissa Alexander's case has touched people all around the country, all around the world, and certainly in her hometown of Jacksonville, Florida. Her case really reflects many, many different kinds of urgent issues, including the need to end domestic violence in all communities, including black communities, and the need to really take a serious look at the impact of mass incarceration and mandatory minimums on black communities in the U.S. And so we're hoping to mobilize supporters of Marissa all over the country from July 25th through August 1st, Standing Our Ground Week. We're going to converge in Jacksonville and have a whole week of action. We're calling it the People's Investigation, and we're looking at different locations where Marissa's case has not been treated with the respect and support that it deserves. And we're going to be asking some critical questions and having some important discussions throughout the entire week. We'll begin by acknowledging the one-year anniversary of the acquittal of George Zimmerman, the lack of accountability for his murder of Trayvon Martin. And then throughout the week, we'll continue to organize, and it will close on August 1st, which is the hearing for Marissa Alexander, where she'll learn if she'll get a new Stand Your Ground hearing, which will hopefully, if she does get that hearing, will give her immunity from this very, very unjust prosecution.
By using the term Stand Our Ground Week, you're actually facing directly the differing attitudes towards that phrase by some very different kinds of people. Stand Your Ground is, of course, the law that many folks think was passed to give white folks the right to shoot black folks at will. And yet Stand Your Ground is what supporters of Marissa Alexander say she was righteously doing on that night that she was arrested.
That's right. We want to really redefine and reconceptualize what standing our ground really means. It doesn't mean the terrible, tragic murders of our children in our communities with no kind of community accountability or redress. When we say stand our ground, we're talking about the right of black people to live, including the right of black women to live, the right of black women to defend themselves from violence in their own homes, violence in the streets, and really expand what self-defense entails. And so sometimes self-defense can be forced, as we've seen with Marissa Alexander. For people who aren't familiar with the case, she was attacked by her abusive estranged husband. He strangled her and threatened to kill her. And she fired a warning shot. She caused no injuries. And for that, she was arrested and prosecuted and sentenced to 20 years. She was able to appeal that sentence, but the state has insisted on re-prosecuting her, and this time she faces the real threat of 60 years mandatory sentence. So we really want to think about all of the conditions in which black women are trying to defend themselves and trying to have their lives. And that includes a number of things. It includes economic justice. It includes the end of all kinds of gender violence. It includes the real urgency to undo mass incarceration, beginning with the repeal of all kinds of mandatory minimums. And it also includes the right to reproductive justice, the right to mother their children in peace without the fear of their children being taken by some vigilante like George Zimmerman, or by police officers, or by people in the community. And so we really want to expand what it means to stand our ground, to really define the ground on which we stand and the condition in which we want to live our lives.
And yet, by saying that this is a stand your ground movement, you do meet visceral reaction, I'm sure, from folks whose opposition to the Florida law that's called Stand Your Ground is intense.
Well, it's not a movement for the Stand Your Ground law, so we should be very clear about that. It is not a movement for the Stand Your Ground law. We certainly hope that Marissa Alexander can use any law that she has, you know, available to get her out of prison. And so to the extent that Stand Your Ground is a law, a functioning law in the state of Florida, we certainly support her to use that law to get out of prison because she, of course, has been incarcerated and prosecuted unjustly. It's a real emergency. Women's self-defense should always be supported. That said, this movement, this convergence, is about redefining a vision for what standing our ground means. And so we really want to push people to think more expansively about what it means to have safety in our communities and to mother safely in our communities and to have a peaceful home and to defend that right, to defend the right of Black women to live and to know that Black lives matter. And so that's what we mean when we say standing our ground. It's not about the law.
Tell us about the growth of the movement that began with Marissa Alexander's case, but how it's reached into different groups and organizations and merged the agendas of already existing movements.
The movement to free Marissa Alexander began in Jacksonville, in her hometown, where she defended her life and where she was prosecuted. And so the wonderful organizers and activists in Jacksonville connected with people all around the nation to really build an infrastructure to hold this beautiful movement for peace and freedom. It includes Alita Alston Ture, who is Jacksonville-based from the new Jim Crow movement, Sumaya Coleman from the African-American Black Women's Cultural Alliance, Helen Gilbert from Radical Women, and myself, Elise Vieira from Insight. And that's just the core team of the Free Marissa Now movement mobilization campaign. But the campaign actually includes thousands and thousands of people. There are organizing bases in Chicago, in Seattle, in Pittsburgh, New York, Los Angeles, the Bay Area, D.C., New Orleans. So there's all these places, all these locales that are organizing locally to really think carefully about the intersections that Marissa's case represents. And it represents these intersections of domestic violence, the right to self-defense, mass incarceration, reproductive justice. And we really want to make sure that as we do community education and community organizing around the movement to free Marissa, that all of these issues are being addressed meaningfully. We also want to make sure that the networks to end domestic violence, of course, there are many domestic violence service organizations around the country and state coalitions to end domestic violence. We really want to engage that community to really think carefully about the impact of mass incarceration on survivors of domestic violence. The fact that Marissa was sent to prison for self-defense is unfortunately not an unusual thing to happen for survivors. Survivors of domestic violence, especially Black women, are regularly criminalized for surviving domestic violence. So it's an emergency. It's something that we really have to pay attention to. The case really challenges us to grow on a number of social justice issues, and we really want to pull together and mobilize people all around the country and all around the world, but especially locally in Jacksonville, to make sure that our voices are heard.
Yes, discussions of mass Black incarceration usually revolve around the plight of Black men, but this movement provides an opportunity to talk about how the sisters fare under the criminal justice system as well.
That's right, and it's really important to consider that. You know, for quite a long time, Black women were the fastest growing population in prisons. And even now, I think that you can see the impact of criminalization, certainly in the context of incarceration and mandatory minimums. But you can also see the impact of criminalization on Black women outside of prison. So there's a lot of surveillance of Black women. There's a lot of policing and police violence against Black women. And because we usually only think about police brutality and mass incarceration through the context of the lives of Black men, this kind of police and prison violence against Black women becomes very invisible in those discussions. We really have to think about the ways in which that kind of violence can be really gendered when Black women and other women are experiencing sexual assault by police and inside of prisons by security guards, and other kinds of ways in which the experience of mass incarceration is gendered. Another issue is motherhood and the ways in which prisons are a reproductive justice issue. The majority of women in prison are mothers, 70%. And, you know, we have to really think about the impact on Black children because mothers are usually the primary caretakers. There are a lot of different kinds of issues that we need to think about. And the other thing is that 90% of women in prison are survivors of domestic violence or sexual violence. And so there seems to be a pretty clear connection between the impact of violence in women's lives and the road to incarceration. So there are a lot of different ways that we have to think about this, and we really hope to think about it together so that we can keep pushing on our analysis around mass incarceration.
Alyssa Bieria, an organizer of Stand Our Ground Week in Jacksonville, Florida. A nationwide coalition of family members of imprisoned people is based in El Paso, Texas. It's called the Beyond Innocence Project, not to be confused with Barry Scheck's Innocence Project. Carolyn Esparza explains what the Beyond Innocence Project is about.
Well, while we can think of nothing worse than being incarcerated for something someone did not do, and we've even executed innocent people, there are tens of thousands of individuals who are incarcerated excessively. They've been unjustly tried. The Center for Prosecutor Integrity, it's doing a tremendous job in exposing some of the corruption in our courts and how people are being railroaded into convictions that are essentially over-convicted, that they've overcharged them with crimes that didn't really happen the way that they're making them sound to happen. And then they excessively sentence them. I received a letter just the other day from a gentleman in California who has committed two adult crimes. And I don't know him, so I can't vouch for him, but I believe what he said because I hear it all the time. He was charged with armed robbery, and no one was injured in either of his crimes. But what they did was they made the one crime into multiple crimes to make him eligible for their three strikes law so that they could give him a life sentence when he was really eligible for something like a 20-year sentence. And that was the maximum that he should have gotten was 20 years, but he got a life sentence. So what he's asking is he supposed to pay with his life, essentially, when he never took a life and he never even physically harmed a person? Of course, he's traumatized people by his crimes, and we do care about victims of crimes. No one should be victimized by anyone. However, we're not setting a very good example as a country when we turn around and victimize perpetrators for victimizing people. Two wrongs don't make a right. And so you asked the question was, why do we call it Beyond Innocence? The reason we call it that is that there are issues far beyond innocence alone that really need to be addressed, and we really need the media's attention on the over-sentencing, the over-convicting of individuals who really didn't deserve what they got from the courts. And no one is looking at them. The Innocence Projects are critically important. They can't begin to help all the people that are innocent within prisons. They even alone consider that we at least have a minimum of 20,000 people today who are wrongly incarcerated. Now, you can, you know, multiply that probably by 5 or 10 more times, and so we probably have 100,000 people in our prisons that are wrongly convicted. However, we, by the same token, we have people who have been overly sentenced, and they don't deserve that either. And someone needs to stand up and speak for them, and a number of us got together and just felt that we needed to present this to the media and let you all know that we really need help to expose the corruption that's going on that's causing this to happen.
And you emphasize families getting involved with this mass incarceration process. Many opponents of U.S. mass incarceration say that's where the base of activism should come from the many millions, in fact, of family members who are directly affected by this.
Absolutely. If we don't stand up for the people that we love and care about, nobody else will, which is why we reached out to the families of the incarcerated to join us in this project. And they're scared to speak out. Families are very frightened to speak out because typically when we speak out against the system at any level, there's retaliation on our loved one in prison. And we have to assure that our loved ones are ready for that before we can speak out. And it's not fair, it's not just, but then life isn't always fair, and we understand that. But we have to make it fairer if there is such a thing. My major concern is a young man here in Texas who received what in Texas is a life sentence, a 60-year sentence is his life sentence in Texas, for a crime that he probably should have gotten 5 years for. He was initially told he was getting probation, but through a series of violations of his constitutional rights, they ended up giving him a 60-year sentence and also assured that he would be unable to appeal that through the courts.
It's been more than 40 years since the United States embarked on a public policy of mass incarceration, but mass incarceration is also a private enterprise affair, and you think that's what's contributing to these abuses?
Definitely. Because prison has become an industry, it's a very profitable industry in this country. The courts are playing the game very well. I assure you that these prisons stay full. Many people are unaware of the privatization problem that you mentioned. First of all, many people have invested heavily, and so they're cutting corners, but they're also assuring and demanding of the states that they maintain those beds at 90% capacity for 20 years before they'll sign a contract with the states. In order to do that, we have to arrest more people, convict more people, assess longer sentences, and certainly deny paroles when they're very well earned. I know too many people that have done wonderful jobs, gone to college, got 2 degrees, done everything that they possibly could do, and were totally eligible for parole, but have been denied and denied and denied because they've got to keep those beds full. And so the profit that's being made by these prisons is billions of dollars. I believe I read recently that the three primary private prison corporations netted so much money, so many billions of dollars, that they had so much profit that they were able to give each of their top executives a $3 million bonus for the year. Now, that's not how prison it was ever intended to be. I mean, essentially, you know, we're back to the days of slavery, and we're getting private prisons are having free labor. Prisoners produce items that are for sale, and the sales don't go back to the prisoners. The profits from the sales go to the prisons. There's huge industries in even the phones, the prison phone system. They're making tremendous profits off of the prison phones. People want to hear from their loved ones in prison. Until recently, some people were paying $25 for a 15-minute phone call. Now we pay $5, or actually it rounds out to about $7 with all the expenses for a 20-minute phone call. The criminal justice system is really destroying the fabric of our culture. When you're taking out of our society talented, bright, and capable young people, not providing them treatment, not providing them encouragement and education, and instead just locking them up in a box and isolating them from society, they have nothing to contribute. And that's deteriorating the quality of our life in these communities. And also with regard to the families, when a loved one is incarcerated, the prison family tends to isolate and withdraw in shame and embarrassment.
Carolyn Esparza of the Beyond Innocence Project in El Paso, Texas. An important deadline is about to pass for preventing the Federal Communications Commission from putting the Internet firmly in corporate hands. The FCC's attempt to destroy internet neutrality has provoked as much public outrage as back in 2003, when George Bush's FCC tried to change the rules to allow huge media corporations to vastly increase their ownership of TV and radio stations. We spoke with Kevin Zeese of Popular Resistance.
The outcry has been incredible. We don't know the final number yet. We expect it will be in the several millions, though. Already, in fact, this year, 2 to 3 million have sent FCC comments about their support for net neutrality. And now we're in this current phase where we're seeing another outcry. And the last big one, of course, was the media consolidation. And before that, the misplacement of the Internet and into an information service where it can't be regulated as clearly in the public interest. And so it takes more than the public outcry and public comments. I mean, what we have to do is people have to be not just responding in the comment period, which is important, but they also have to be organized and mobilized when this gets to the next stage. After the comment period's over, we need to be pressuring the FCC and pressuring Congress and the White House. So we got a lot of work ahead to protect this amazing communications resource, the Internet, and not let them destroy it.
This could have been the moment that progressives were waiting for, a Democratic majority on the FCC, a Democratic chairman, a case that could obviously open up the opportunity to declare the Internet to be a common carrier, and it all went in the opposite direction, at least so far.
Well, you know, we've already had an impact, and you're right. This commission was, all five members were appointed by President Obama. Under the communications law, he's required to appoint two from the alternative party, the Republicans in this case. So we have a 3-2 majority of Democrats to Republicans, all appointed by President Obama. So this is the Obama Commission, and President Obama ran for office saying he would not take a backseat to anyone supporting net neutrality, that he would fight to the death to protect net neutrality. And so now we'll see if he's true to his word. And, of course, we know that history. Tom Wheeler, the chairman, comes out of the industry. He has won the Hall of Fame for both the broadband and the telecom industries. So he's a two-time Hall of Famer, and President Obama made that point when he nominated him. Now we hope we can push him to become the People's Commissioner. And we've seen some progress. When his first proposal was leaked, it didn't include any discussion of common carrier. After 2 weeks, nearly 2 weeks of protests, including us occupying the FCC with a full side of the building covered with camps and tents and people sleeping out there, and lots of people sending in comments and phone calls before the new rules announced, we were able to add to the rulemaking process the issue of common carrier status. We got our issue on the agenda. And now we're seeing people just commenting in gigantic numbers in favor of the idea of a common carrier. This is the first phase. It ends on July 15th. After that, we have a rebuttal comment period that will end on September 10th. And that rebuttal will be to, we'll look at what Comcast and Verizon and AT&T have said they want, and we'll rebut that in public comments. We're also pushing the commissioners to hold regional hearings around the country so they can actually see people face-to-face and hear directly from them. They're pretty isolated in their ivory tower there, and written comments just don't really portray to them what this really means to people. So we hope that will be a part of the process. And if it is, I think we'll see a much more organized constituency, more mobilized constituency. I think we have a really good chance of winning this in the FCC. We have two Republicans who oppose any regulation, two Democrats who, everything they've said, have leaned in our direction, and Wheeler in the middle, who's now put forward both approaches. He has his own approach of his fee-based tiers, but he also put forward in the rulemaking common carrier. So now he's left himself a back door. We have to now help him through it and show him that that's the best solution.
Grassroots organizations are doing their best at trying to organize people, but the folks who want to privatize and corporatize the Internet, they have the power of money.
Well, that's always the conflict in the United States. It's the plutocrats versus the people. I think we've seen some successes by the people in blocking progress, for example, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and blocking Obama's repeated efforts to destroy Social Security. And we've seen progress on this front in that we got the common carrier issue on the agenda. So I think that people are more organized now in some ways than they have been in the past. Since the Occupy Rebellion and the public encampments that that involved, people realized they were no longer alone and that they could get organized and have an impact. And people are more willing to do more than just operate within the system with public comments. They're much more willing to do sit-ins and protests and marches and really stop the government and show its illegitimacy. So I think we have a really good chance, but it's going to take people being mobilized. The first phase of the mobilization is this public comment period, but after that we have to really get mobilized in the streets and in their offices and show them that we're going to stop government if they destroy the Internet.
Now, more people understand, or at least think they understand, the meaning of the term Internet neutrality now mm-hmm. than used to be the case. But one of the things that you're demanding is that there be rules that allow cities and other public authorities to own Internet providers. What's that mean?
It means that rather than the Internet being owned by Comcast or Verizon, those are the companies that bring it to your home or to your phone, the Internet would be owned by a municipality, like a public utility, and that would be controlled by the public through the local government, and that would it's made it much more responsive. Chattanooga, for example, has an Internet provided by a public utility, and it's the fastest and least expensive Internet in the country. We in the United States ranks in the 30s as far as quality of Internet service, speed of service, and I think that mainly is because we're dominated by corporations who seek to profit rather than provide great service. So when you have a public utility providing the service, the goal is different. The goal of the corporation is profit. The goal of the public utility is provide public service. And that's really the two choices. And, in the long run, I'd like to see that nationally. I think the Internet is a public service that is becoming human right. It's intertwined in every aspect of our life. People need to have a high-quality access. And what net neutrality, by the way, means, just for your listeners who might not still understand it, net neutrality means an open Internet without discrimination with equal access to all. It does not mean what part of the proposal of the current rulemaking is, which is a tiered Internet based on fees, where big corporations can pay for better service. And that way, younger, new ideas, innovators, entrepreneurs have a much harder time getting in the market. You wouldn't have YouTube and Upworthy. You wouldn't have Kickstarter and Wikipedia if we had roadblocks put in front of corporations that had to pay extra to get decent service. And so that's the idea, is to keep the providers, Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, neutral. They just bring the wire to your house or to your phone, and then after that it's a fair surface where everybody can compete and innovation can continue.
And those countries, and there are so many of them, that provide better Internet service than the United States, most of them have much more public involvement.
Yes, and that's one of the real problems with the United States' influence on the world economy. You know, through these globalized trade agreements, we're essentially trying to rig the economy for transnational corporations. And so in countries that rely on government-supported or government-run services, those are not popular in these draft agreements that our government is trying to push through secretly. And they want to do away with state-owned or state-supported enterprises. And, in fact, those work better in many areas, like healthcare, like telecommunications. They really provide public service rather than personal profit. And so it's a shame to see the United States having that kind of influence, but that's what hegemony by a worldwide empire, which the United States is, that's what we produce. And it's not good for our economy. It's not good for our people. It's not good for the people of the world. It's only good for a small percentage of plutocrats who get extreme wealth and expand the wealth divide. And that's what we're trying to push toward on this issue as well. And hopefully the people can organize to stop it.
Kevin Zeese of Popular Resistance. The Israelis are once again acting as the military bullies of the Middle East. Mumia Abu-Jamal has this report for Prison Radio.
The biblical tale of David versus Goliath is the quintessential story of how the weak can prevail over the mighty. It gives people hope that perhaps they can prevail over terrible adversity. In the Middle East, that tale continues to be told, but from the somewhat peculiar perspective that Israel, the Zionist state, is David. This is how most Americans receive and seem to want their Mideast news. Perhaps it's more comforting, but it's not so. Israel has the most powerful military in the region, and it is the most aggressive. Back before the 1970s, Egypt could have made such a claim, but today, billions of U.S. dollars later, they're only a threat to their own population. Today, Israel is Goliath, and Palestine is David. They throw stones while Israel fields F-16 fighters, attack aircraft that can destroy football fields in a blink. They, the Palestinians, have no standing army, no air force, and no real standing in international affairs. They are an occupied people. They are a captive people. When Obama issues statements about restraint on both sides, well, that's political hogwash. For Obama, who spent his time as a state politician in the company of Palestinian intellectuals like Ali Abu Nima, knows well who is the best armed party to the conflict and who isn't. He knows well who is Goliath and who is David. And David has little more than a stone and a prayer.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, reporting for Prison Radio. The Obama administration says it's expanding sanctions against those who are responsible for violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where 6 million people have died in the greatest genocide since World War II. However, the sanctions list does not include the leaders of U.S. allies Rwanda and Uganda, which have been most responsible for the last 18 years of mass murder. Kambale Musavuli of Friends of Congo says President Obama is simply acting on an executive order issued by his predecessor, George Bush.
This is the executive order that George Bush wrote when he was president. It's unclear how people end up on the list. There's hundreds of names of individuals and companies who are listed there, but they are all small-time players. For people to actually think that this executive order, which is an old executive order that's been updated, is going to be effective, is if we see the name of James Kabarebe, the Rwandan Minister of Defense, Charles Kayonga, who's also in the Rwandan military, Frank Zinza in the Rwandan military. Those are individuals that have been listed by the UN Group of Experts as directly supporting, training, equipping, and financing rebels in the Congo. And they could not do that without the actions being condemned by the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. So Paul Kagame's name, president of Rwanda, his name is not on the list as well. Joseph Kabila, the president of the Congo, for the many issues of being part of the forces that committed the massacres in Kindi in 1997, obviously thing of different issues. Well, one can say those are Congolese issues, but he's still not on the list. Oh, Yoweri Museveni, whose government has been found liable for war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Congo, in the International Court of Justice, and Uganda owes Congo $10 billion in reparations. Yes, his name is not on the list. So the big noise that so far that we're hearing, all this noise around this new updated or amended executive order, it is business as usual. How will I know that things have changed? It's if concrete actions are taken against the individuals that I've mentioned. If not, we are continuing from George Bush doctrine to Obama doctrine, we're still the same, where they are still exploiting Africa, supporting Africa's strong men, and bringing them to Washington for breakfast, lunch, and dinner in August.
But they seem to be getting great propaganda value out of this.
Exactly. That's how they frame the press release. Because people probably do not notice that it says new amended executive order. And they did not go back to see the original executive order written by George Bush. And again, you have to keep this in mind. Well, this is the last term of President Barack Obama. And he is going to be judged on how he handled the Congo. On June 30th, a Forbes magazine published an article calling Obama a neocon, explaining his handling of Congo, how it's completely different than how he's handling other issues around the world. I do not agree with the author's analysis that we should have a consistent policy for Congo as we have from the Middle East. That means, again, more and more deaths, right? But what was really enlightening about this article of Forbes is that the author pointed out that right now Western nations know that Joseph Kabila of the Congo has stolen $15 billion of aid money that we provide to this country. So he has $15 billion in his offshore account. And we already reading that in articles right now. Right now also in the same articles is pointing out how they are not holding the perpetrator of violence accountable. So I see the connection with the latest Forbes magazine article coming out exposing Obama's Africa policy, how it is even worse than the Republicans, bringing Africa on the continent, more militarism for the continent, supporting strong men, worse than Bush ever done. That press seems to divert their attention around holding Barack Obama accountable. We have African dictators who are being invited in the White House right now by this president while he's posting this executive order. We should look at the invitation that he's bringing them here and say, all right, why? Did he do that when they come to the White House? No. But what's even more disheartening, this president is also responsible for the so-called Young African Leaders Initiative. So the president of the United States, who is supporting African dictators who have blood on their hands, is bringing young Africans in the United States to teach them about leadership. What is it that they are going to teach these young Africans? When these young Africans are witnessing how he's re-inviting them to the White House, ignoring the will of the people, continuing to supporting them with financial support and military support. That's what needs to be the biggest story. Not this PR propaganda that's being pushed out of the Secretary of Treasury, the State Department, and the White House.
Yes, in terms of good governance, which is what Obama says Africa needs, he admonishes the government of Congo, thefts by that head of state notwithstanding, for not providing services to the eastern part of the country. But his allies almost severed the eastern part of the country from the rest of the Congo and have made it almost impossible to tax corporations that were active extracting minerals from that part of the country.
Yes, and now the story now should be, how can we make sure that the American people are even aware that right now, in the heart of Africa, due to U.S. foreign policy, due to the so-called Obama doctrine for the African continent, we have millions of people who have died and they still don't have justice. We have corporations looting our resources and no one is holding them accountable. I mean, when you turn on the news, you hear about many issues. You know, you're hearing Syria, you're hearing Palestine, but we're supporting the people of Palestine right now as well. But the same situation with Israel and Palestine is similar to what is happening with Rwanda and Congo, where Rwanda is a country as the Israel of Africa. No matter what they do in Central Africa, no one is holding them accountable for anything, simply because there was a genocide in 1994. We have a Holocaust right now in the Congo. And even the president of the United States, who some believe is the son of Africa, has not taken action to bring an end to the deadliest conflict in war since World War II. But what he's able to do is send out a press release about George Bush's executive order, which is quite sad. When will he actually be bold in changing policy? And that's not going to come from him. I am not waiting for the White House to bring about change. The world did not wait for Ronald Reagan to end apartheid, nor Carter, nor Nixon, or nor any other president. Ordinary people organized and mobilized to bring an end to apartheid. That's the call for now. Congolese are not waiting for President Barack Obama to come out of his amnesia and remember what he did when he was a senator by being a Congo advocate. We're not waiting for that. What we are doing right now is mobilizing people around the world and pleading to the American people that your taxpayers' money, what you pay every year, right? On April 15th, they tell you if you don't file your taxes, you will be penalized. You work hard all year long, they take your money, and they use it to fund African dictators in Rwanda, in Uganda, and Congo, while they can't even build adequate school for your children. They can give you no tax cut. They can provide you with decent health care. Yes, they are supporting that. That's what we are informing the American people, that we should hold our government accountable by how they use the taxpayers' money to support chaos around the world. If the American people are able to organize and understand the issue, mobilize and organize to hold the government accountable, that will help not just the Congo, but many countries around the world.
And that's part of the message that you at Friends of Congo are imparting to meetings that you're having in various parts of the country as part of Congo Week.
Yes, and it's what we call the End Apartheid Movement of today. It's the Congo Movement. And we are going from cities to cities, campuses to campuses, churches, mosques, synagogues. Wherever we provide us a space to speak, we come. We bring them the information. We let them know the challenge of the Congolese. We also remind them of the importance of the Congo, a country the size of Western Europe, the only African country with 9 bordering nations, and the potential that's there from its mineral resources to the human potential. We are talking about over 40 million young Congolese under the age of 13 who are ready to transform the whole African continent. That if we can get it right in Congo, it will transform the African continent. So I know I'm saying it. Africa is shaped like a gun, and Congo is the trigger. When you press the trigger, there will be a combustion, an explosion on the African continent. That's the potential of the country. And we bring it to communities to let them know we want you to do Congo Week. We need you to commemorate the lives of the millions of deaths in the Congo. We need you to support the Congolese in the struggle so that they can have peace and stability in their home. And we do it all the way through October, elevating the third week of October as the week everyone around the world needs to stand at the side of the Congolese people.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network. And especially to our engineer, Martin Nwanga.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.